This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Yes, it is Friday, which means time for the Week in Review, starting with the GOP healthcare reform plan.
I'm proud to support the replacement plan released by the House of Representatives and encouraged by members of both parties. I think really that we're going to have something that's going to be much more understood and much more popular than people can even imagine.
We are doing an act of mercy by repealing this law and replacing it with patient-centered healthcare reforms that we as conservatives have been arguing for and fighting for years.
However, Massachusetts Democrats disagree.
I was struck last night by a comment that I heard made by Speaker Ryan, where he called this repeal bill, quote, an act of mercy. With all due respect to our speaker, he and I must have read different scripture. The one that I read calls on us to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, to shelter the homeless, and to comfort the sick.
Essentially what they've come up with is the Affordable Care Act without the affordable part.
That pithy comment from Congressman Seth Moulton and the longer one from Congressman Joe Kennedy. So let's talk about the new health care bill and the rest of this week's news with our Week in Review team. Today it's Renee Loth, editor of Architecture of Boston, columnist for the Boston Globe, and a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti page. Renee, it's so great to see you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Also with us today is Charlie Chipio. He's senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and head of Chipio Strategies. Also great to see you, Charlie.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Let me just start with you, Charlie. So the Republicans have released a healthcare reform plan. It didn't get, you know, an ecstatic reception.
Did not get 4 stars.
No, to say the least. Your reaction to the bill?
Boy, my reaction to the bill is that, you know, I don't like it, but I don't really like Obamacare, and I don't know that I have a proposal for how to fix it. It just the problems seem to be so overwhelming when it comes to healthcare. You know, Obamacare we couldn't afford it, and over time things like this Cadillac tax and things were going to kick in that was going to make it impossible for the government, that was going to make it too expensive for people. But you know, in many ways, this just makes it worse, and I just feel like I'm the worst person to have here because it's like I don't have the pithy answer to say how I would fix it because I don't know.
But you're not alone in terms of people who don't like Obamacare and also don't like this bill as well. I mean, Renee, your thoughts?
Well, first of all, who knew it could be so complicated, healthcare? you know, I think that this new bill tries to square the circle by removing the mandate that requires everybody to have insurance while at the same time propping up the insurance pools that will collapse without younger and healthier people. You know, the Kaiser Family Foundation did an analysis where they compared the subsidies that people get under Obamacare with the tax credits that they would get under the new proposal. And what a surprise, the people who are hurt most are the oldest and the sickest.
Well, let me just
jump
in here because I looked at the Massachusetts-specific numbers from the Kaiser Family Foundation. And, for example, if you earn $30,000 a year in Massachusetts and you are 27 years old, you'll actually see a 75% increase in the subsidies because the subsidies are weighted towards younger people in this new plan. If you're 40, you'll also see a major increase. But if you're 60, your subsidies are in Massachusetts are going to drop by 25%. And then if for anyone who's got incomes above that, basically everyone in Massachusetts with incomes above that gets a big increase. But say you earn $20,000 a year in Massachusetts, you're going to see a 75% decrease in the subsidy.
And that's the problem. I mean, tax credits don't do you much good when you don't earn enough money to pay taxes in the first place. So, you know, to say that it is an imperfect solution is an understatement. And the idea of it being based on age instead of income is also bizarre.
Well, so let me play some tape here because we heard from vastly different opinions on this issue. First of all, this week we spoke with Jonathan Gruber. He was a senior advisor to President Obama when the Affordable Care Act was written during the Obama administration. Here's what he made of the Republican plan.
I mean, essentially what this bill does is take from the sick, the poor, and the elderly and give to the wealthiest 2% of Americans. And it's not clear why anyone besides those wealthiest 2% should be in favor of this law.
But on the other hand, Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price this week also said what he believes that the new Republican plan does is take care of a major flaw that that he sees in Obamacare.
Last year, there were 232 insurers that were providing coverage, that were offering coverage on the exchange. Now there are 167. That's a loss of about 30% in 1 year alone. And all of this means that patients are not getting the care that they need.
Charlie, jump in here. I mean, because we've heard a lot of people say, look, the exchanges in many states either have, they have one insurer or insurers are pulling out.
Right.
Now, the reasons for that are varied and complicated, but it's something we've heard quite a bit. I mean, do you think that just eliminating exchanges and putting everyone on out there in the healthcare marketplace with these subsidies is philosophically a better way to go?
Well, it might be, but when the subsidies are not real, in the sense of the subsidies being, you know, a percentage of taxes that you don't pay, you know, it's ephemeral. It's not real. So I don't really have so much of a philosophical issue with it as just an issue that it just doesn't add up and it's not going to help the people who need most help.
You know, and beyond all of the complicated details, which the president is discovering are there, there's a bigger question here, which is, before Obamacare, there were millions of Americans who were vulnerable to financial ruin just because they had the misfortune of getting sick. And to, to go back to those days and to, going bankrupt, which is, you know, medical bankruptcies were a big factor before Obamacare. And going bankrupt for a family is not the same thing as going bankrupt if you're Donald Trump and it's one of your casinos, okay? You know, so I think to deny people the right to, some sort of financial security just because you're against government involvement in the healthcare sector is really ideological and just cruel.
Right.
Well, and I just think that, you know, fundamentally here, I mean, the question is, it is so sad and it's tragic that instead of a good faith effort to actually fix what's wrong with the system, we have this situation where, you know, the red guys are on one side and they will only do this, and the blue guys are on the other side and they will only do this. And it's just, I mean, let's just, I think
I feel
we could
like
tweak what we have.
You're describing the endless status quo in American
politics. Well, right.
Politics,
and I mean,
this is not
an original thought on my part, but it's...
Well, I want to play one more piece of tape here because, of course, you know, part of what you guys are touching on is that there's so many unanswered questions also about what the actual impact would be on the from the bill on folks across the country. Governor Charlie Baker spoke to WBUR this week about what the bill might mean for Massachusetts.
Our big concern was continuing to be able to do the work that we've done here in Massachusetts, where virtually everybody's covered. And our primary concern is going to be to make sure we can continue to do that for the people of Massachusetts going forward. And on first glance, I'm a little worried about the financing. But again, we need to do more homework on that.
I mean, lots more homework. I mean, the one thing that stops me, and this is not a partisan observation, this is your dollars and cents observation, we don't even have a CBO score.
That, it's amazing.
And they're going to try and push through a vote without actually knowing from the Congressional Budget Office how much this plan would cost and how many millions of people it might affect.
Yeah, and just to look at it from the point of view of our narrow interest in Massachusetts, you know, anytime you're going to be tinkering with the financial system of medical care in this country, it's going to have huge ripple effects in Massachusetts because the healthcare sector is such a big part of our economy. And so, I don't know, it's something like $9 billion that the state of Massachusetts gets from Medicaid, which is vulnerable under this new bill. So there's a lot of concerns for us here,
too. And you hear all the cocktail party chatter about how, well, you know, we had Romney Care, and so we won't be so affected like other places. Well, the reality is that the state cannot offer the kind of subsidies and the kind of help that we need to actually make the numbers add up. So
right.
We will certainly be affected.
And with the Affordable Care Act, with Obamacare, a Massachusetts health reform was pulled into that. So it's very intimately bound up in it. So
precisely,
we can talk for the whole time just about healthcare. But let's move on to another topic, no less controversial, and that is the fact that on Monday of this week, President Donald Trump issued a revised version of his executive order on immigration. Here's Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly explaining his view of the new order on Monday.
We must undertake a rigorous review of our immigration vetting programs to increase our confidence in the decisions we make relative to visitors and immigrants that travel to the United States. We cannot risk the prospect of malevolent actors using our immigration system to take American lives.
Now, the revised order makes several significant changes. One, it takes Iraq off the list of countries with a 90-day visa suspension. And also, it has a whole list of exemptions as well, which we didn't see in the first executive order back in January. But that made no difference to immigration lawyer Susan Church. We spoke with her on Monday.
you can't rewrite the order and pretend that your intent was different in writing the original order. So I think he's very vulnerable just on looks like a Muslim ban, acts like a Muslim ban, talks like a Muslim ban. It's probably still a Muslim ban, no matter how much you rewrite it with the help of some more educated lawyers.
Renee, Muslim ban?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good analysis right there. I mean, it seems to me to be the same old Muslim ban with, six mainly Muslim countries targeted instead of seven. And there are other, small things, or perhaps not so small if you're affected by it, changes that are corrections that have been made, giving more time for this to be implemented so that, there's not panic and chaos at airports, and the green card and visa holders are exempt. But, it still discriminates in a blanket way against mostly Muslim countries without any compelling state interest why this is necessary. And I think it's vulnerable to court challenge.
You do? See, I wonder about that. I think that there's a possibility that this order is more robust and could withstand.
Yeah, and that's
a court
sort
challenge.
Of my, I have sort of I'm of two minds about this. One, and let me just, no one should take legal advice from me. Anybody who has seen my law school transcript would never want to take legal advice from me. But it does seem to me that from a purely legalistic point of view, that this might be carefully tailored enough to pass muster. That may be true. But the other side of me says that, this just goes against everything that our nation is based on. And, I read something about how the administration was bragging about how people sneaking over the border from Mexico has gone down since the announcement. And I read that and I thought to myself, well, yeah, because this order goes against everything that has made people want to come to this country for 250 years.
So let me jump in here, because I feel like there remain many people who look at this new executive order and say, look, it has removed the exemption for Christian immigrant
preference
from the six countries, so that should make it safe for a challenge that it's a quote unquote Muslim ban, and that also they come back to this idea that it's just a pause, it's 90 days, and then for refugees it's 120 days. The blanket ban on Syrian refugees is gone, and so they say, look, this is still, remember what John Kelly, Secretary Kelly, said, this is about making the borders more secure, vetting process and making that more secure, and then also trying to get a hold on preventing any future terrorist attack. And to that end, I want to play some tape from Mark Krikorian. He's executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies. Now, they definitely favor tighter controls on immigration. And here's what he told us.
Do we really want to wait until a Yemeni actually kills Americans before we say, okay, now we should ban people from Yemen? These countries, there is no state. There is no way, and literally no way, to vet people coming from Somalia or Yemen or Libya or Syria.
So, Renee, there are a lot of people out there who would agree with what he says. How do you how would you tell them? Nevertheless, this is a ban that's un-American.
Yeah, in a way, he's making my point, which is that we fear terrorist actors who are not state actors. They are these kind of freelancers in this shadowy terrorist network, and so banning people from a particular country, from a particular state, is not going to solve the problem. The problem is individuals who need to be carefully vetted. At the same time that this bill is being pushed, the president's proposed budget cuts funding for the Coast Guard, it cuts funding for the TSA, it cuts funding for all these other, security, border security efforts in order to have enough money to build this crazy wall he wants to build. And so you have to wonder how serious they are about really trying to find the bad actors and not just, making a kind of a broad brush point about the enemy out there.
Hmm. And I think they clearly are just trying to make a broad brush. I mean, he was certainly not shy about saying what this was during the campaign. Hmm. The problem is that the law is historically not so good at discerning intent, you know, and that's what it comes down to.
Well, I should note that Attorney General Maura Healey announced yesterday that Massachusetts is joining a lawsuit that's challenging President Trump's new immigration ban. There's also another one, I think, out of Hawaii. So we'll see what happens in the courts. All right, let's move on to another bit of news that sort of unfolded this week, but technically took place last week, I should say, because this was what happened at Middlebury College. On Thursday night, major protests broke out after a controversial speaker, Charles Murray, tried to take a stage to give a speech at the college. He'd been invited by a student group. He's very controversial. We'll talk about that, Wyatt, in just a second. But students, in response, stood up, turned their backs to him, started protesting and chanting, and they essentially did not let him speak. And Professor Allison Stanger, she was scheduled to moderate a discussion with Murray. She tried. Here she is.
I spent a lot of time preparing really hard questions. We're going to have a great dialogue if you let us continue. I'm here and it is a dialogue. Yeah, I think I have the answer. You're not going to let us speak. I think that's a terrible shame.
Now, we've had contentious protests like this on campuses before, but really it's what happened after that that made a lot of people around the nation take pause, and that is Charles Murray and Professor Stanger, upon trying to leave a room, were actually attacked, and Professor Stanger's neck was injured. So lots of questions once again about the health of free speech on college campuses. Charlie Chipio, what do you make of it?
Well, look, free speech has been on the endangered list at college campuses for a long time. This is only the most recent example. And I guess, you know, in my view, in my dotage, I am my disdain for the both extremes of the ideological spectrum only grows. And
I'm not in my dotage, and I agree.
And, you know, I just, this is just the latest example of that. You know, this is just outrageous. It just should not happen. Would I invite Charles Murray? Would I want to go see Charles Murray? No. But a legitimate group or a group invited him. And, you know,
Renee?
You can't behave this way.
You know, Charlie and I agree. Here we are on this moment, and you can mark it in your calendars. I mean, of course, Charles Murray should have been allowed to speak. You know, if you can't have an open dialogue about difficult questions on a college campus and, you know, a university, then where can you have that? I think that the students also had a right to protest, but in my view, you know, quite apart from the violence, which is never, you know, supported and wrong. But in my view, they would have been better off, the students, to have marshaled their arguments and tried to have an intelligent, you know, conversation with Murray and to refute his odious ideas. It would better prepare them for life in the real world.
Yep.
And it might even have been a useful thing for Murray to have seen some, you know, intelligent pushback to his theories. Now he gets to be a free speech martyr.
Yes.
And take the high ground and the high road, and it's just appalling.
Yeah. And Renee makes a good point, by the way. I'm certainly not saying that these folks don't have the right to protest, but they certainly don't have the right to, like, give this woman a concussion or to stop Murray from being able to speak.
Yeah, see, here's what my take on this is, that by protesting in the manner that they did, it seemed as if they were feeling that their only option was to not have any kind of dialogue. And to me, that puts the students in a position of weakness, which is not necessary at all. I mean, we had a Middlebury student on the show this week, Elizabeth Suyon Lee, who gave a thoughtful view of support for the protesters. And it wasn't so much what she said, but she came on this show. It was a live radio program, mm-hmm. thousands of listeners. There was a professor on the show as well who very strongly disagreed with her. But by being on the program, she proved that as a student, she was able to have a robust, intelligent, passionate dialogue. And I just wish we could have seen that at Middlebury.
Right.
And that's what I want. I keep coming back to. I think students underestimate themselves in terms of their ability to have vigorous dialogue.
If you can get into Middlebury, you can probably capable of pretty good dialogue, I would think.
All right, so we've just got just enough time for our hubbubs. That's the news that maybe the happier news that we should have spent more time talking about. Renee, your hubbub.
Well, you know, I just have to give a shout out to Haley Evans. She's the Brookline High School senior who found a creative way to raise money for some of her favorite charities. What she does is she tracks down people who are on the unclaimed money lists that the state treasuries put out. And then when she finds these happy recipients, you know, she asks them if they would donate a little bit of their windfall to her favorite charities. And so far, she's raised over $8,000 for literacy and early childhood education programs. So she is both a finder and a keeper. Congratulations to Haley Evans.
Great story. Yeah. Charlie, your hubbub?
Well, you know, Massachusetts may have binders full of women, thanks to the famous quote by former Governor Romney. But Rhode Island State House apparently has file cabinets full of booze, according to freshman state representative Maura Walsh. She said that her statement was that we can't operate motor vehicles when you've had two beers, but we make laws that affect people's lives forever when they're half in the bag. Brings to mind for those of us of a certain age who remember the toga party, right? The late night antics during the House debate in Massachusetts, which did essentially turn into a toga party. And I guess my conclusion from the whole thing is that sometimes I think that Rhode Island exists just to make we in Massachusetts feel a little better about ourselves.
All right. Well, my hubbub has to do with the Fox TV show MasterChef Junior, because my colleague Lisa Mullen spoke with two Massachusetts MasterChef Juniors, Lila DeLuca of Rockport and Sam Brock of Concord. These kids are they're whiz kids chefs. And here's what they told Lisa.
Yes, we had to do a roasted beet with a sauce vierge.
Okay, sauce what?
Vierge.
What's that?
It's like a vinaigrette with
It's a vinaigrette, tomatoes. But a lot more chunky.
How do you guys know that and I don't?
Because we're junior chefs.
We're
on MasterChef Junior. There's a reason why we're on MasterChef Junior.
Sadly, Sam was eliminated, but Lila's still on the show. Congratulations to both of them. Invite us over for dinner. We're waiting for our invitations. Charlie Chippio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and head of Chippio Strategies, and Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe. Thank you both so much.
Great. Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.